Travel anywhere in the world, and you'll see that what we grew up believing about America is still true. Despite all the huge changes that have taken place, increased competition from other countries, the falling cost of labor in the world economy, and the revolution wrought by high technology, this is still the land of opportunity. Still the one place where everything you need for success is within reach. Today, you still have a real chance to turn your dreams into reality, to make yourself into exactly what you want to be, no matter who you are or where you start from. Some people might disagree with me about that, but I know it's true. That's why we should be doing everything we can to make the most of the opportunities that have been given to us. Of course, lots of men and women are doing just that. I've seen success happen for a great many people, and I'd like to think that maybe I've helped it along for some of them. Yes, we still live in the age of opportunity, but let's look for a moment at some of the important changes that have taken place in the world. For one thing, there are more people throughout the world who have access to the spectrum of technological advances. They have cars in their garages, they have VCRs, computers, satellite dishes, all of it. And I say good for them, because when you've worked hard for it, and you've finally gotten it, having a lot of nice stuff is fun. But I also say take care, or maybe even beware, because the stuff that really matters can get buried under everything else. The right stuff can get smothered under all the plastic and shiny metal. The inner resources that will sustain you when the clock strikes midnight and the carriage turns into a pumpkin, those inner resources can start to get lost. And what you've got becomes a little less important than what you are. I'm talking about character now. I'm talking about leadership, too, the ability to inspire yourself that qualifies you, that gives you the right, that makes you worthy to lead others. Does it seem to you that a lot of people are succeeding these days without the benefit of a strongly developed character? It does seem that way to me sometimes. But I think some very positive signs are beginning to appear. I think we're starting to realize that we'd better remember what got us this far if we expect to go any farther. And because you're listening to me right now, I know you understand the importance of character. You're the kind of person I had in mind when I decided to create a program that reveals the major ideas I've learned about character and leadership. You're the one I want to talk to, and I'm glad you've decided to join me.
Welcome to Cultivating an Unshakable Character with Jim Rohn, America's foremost business philosopher. In this program, Jim looks at the 12 essential pillars for all personal and professional success. When you hear his straightforward, tried-and-true approach to character building, you'll learn exactly what you must do in order to make yourself a person who truly deserves success. The challenge and the opportunity is yours for the taking, and the rewards can be enormous for you and for those who look to you for leadership. Now let's rejoin Jim as he looks at what really defines an unshakable character and discusses the first and perhaps most important pillar of all, the quality of courage.
There are lots of differences between people, and the differences express themselves in all sorts of ways. Some want a big car, and some prefer a small car. Some people like to swim, and some like to ski. Some like to stay up late, others like to go to bed early. Those are rather obvious differences, and they probably aren't really very important. But here's one that I've come to believe is quite critical. I think one of the sharpest distinctions between people is between the small percent who look words up in the dictionary and the overwhelming majority that don't. I confess that I was a member of that overwhelming majority for many years, But some time ago, I started to adopt the habit, and I can see the benefits today in trying to understand a big subject like character. I find it especially helpful when I discover something about the origins of words in ancient or foreign languages. When I began planning this program, I looked up the word character in the dictionary. I learned the origin of the word, and then I just sat there for a minute and realized that in this case, the origin of the word just about says it all. So I'm going to tell you where the word character comes from, and I'd hope it has as big an effect on you as it did on me. But first I want to just quickly mention the origins of another word that people often confuse with character, just to clarify the differences. That other word is charisma, and I think that it's often confused with character today. But charisma is really quite different. Charisma is derived from a Greek word meaning an ability to elicit favor in other people. It's a magnetic quality of personality that people respond to as if it were magic. Charisma is almost like a magic wand that confers power over others. But character has a very different origin. Character comes from a Greek word meaning chisel, or the mark left by a chisel. I'm going to repeat that because I think it's very important. Character is derived from the Greek word for chisel. And of course, a chisel is a sharp steel tool used for making a sculpture out of a hard or difficult material like granite or marble. And a chisel is also used for stripping away waste material from an object, stripping away stuff that might get in the way in order to get down to the essential thing, the thing that really matters. So in its origins, the word character isn't related to a word like charisma, which we've described as a kind of magic wand. Character isn't a magic wand. Character comes from chisel. And I hope you'll remember that. You've got to chisel your character out of the raw material of yourself, just like a sculptor has to create a statue. The raw material is always there. Everything that happens to you, good or bad, is an opportunity for building your character. Let me point out another important distinction between character and charisma. You may have noticed it already. In both its definition and its derivation, character doesn't refer to other people. It doesn't refer to having power over other people or getting other people to follow you or gaining favor with other people. Character is something that you have and that you are. You could be marooned on a desert island, and your character would still be important. In fact, it would likely be very important in that situation. But charisma wouldn't do you any good at all. Charisma requires the presence of others, while character is all about you. Character is the person you are after you've chiseled and chiseled, and have gotten past all the unnecessary material to what's underneath. But since we're usually surrounded by other people, let me be a little more specific about how the differences between a charismatic person and a person with character can play out in the real world, particularly in leadership situations. Here are four sets of circumstances that can easily occur. First, a really charismatic person can make people believe there's pie in the sky, or that the sky is going to fall tomorrow, one just as easily as the other. By creating these expectations, charismatic individuals can indeed energize and inspire others, or terrify and demotivate them, until the overblown scenarios are proven false and the charisma runs out. But a person of character doesn't need to be anyone's Pied Piper and isn't comfortable in that role. Instead, he or she looks within for the true source of inspiration and energy. Second, a charismatic person can inspire devoted or even fanatical loyalty. But this can all too easily turn into an unconscious sense of dependency, and that can make matters difficult when the leader is no longer available. Like a charismatic coach, effective during the glory years, but when he leaves the organization, there is a sense of abandonment, and the team may never achieve anything like its prior success. Powerful personalities often resist delegating authority, but it's an attitude of character for a leader to refrain from making himself or herself the indispensable heart and soul of an organization. Here's a third difference between character and charisma that's particularly important in a leadership situation. Charismatic people have to keep pulling rabbits out of the hat. The magic of their presence has got to keep expressing itself, or people might start wondering where it went. Worse yet, they might start getting bored. During the Second World War, Dwight Eisenhower was picked to command the Allied forces in Europe, not because he was an exciting leader with a sense of high drama, but precisely because he wasn't. There were plenty of charismatic individuals around, such as Churchill, Montgomery, de Gaulle, and Patton. What was needed was somebody with toughness, stamina, and ability to manage people. Just before the Normandy invasion in 1944, Eisenhower met with a group of officers who would be going into battle. He stretched out a piece of string on a table and pulled it a few inches with his finger. "An army is like this piece of string," he said. "If you try to push it from behind, it just tangles and doubles back on itself. Soldiers have to be led from the front, not pushed from behind." Eisenhower may not have been colorful, but he could definitely get his point across in a way anyone could understand. He had character in the true sense. One of the biggest pitfalls for a charismatic leader comes straight from his or her ability to inspire love and devotion. And this is the last point I want to make. In order to bask in the warm glow of a leader's approval, people may become reluctant to voice disagreements. There are people who become isolated because subordinates are afraid of them. But the same isolation can occur as a result of misplaced affection. People of character are usually well loved by everyone around them, but they make it clear that their own first love is for the truth, even if it hurts. Character and charisma are topics that have been defined and debated for thousands of years. And I want to close this discussion with a comparison between two historical personalities. Alexander the Great was undoubtedly the most charismatic leader who ever lived. He lived only to the age of 33, but he personally led his armies into one victorious battle after another, first in Greece, then Persia, then Egypt, and finally India. It wasn't always easy, however. Alexander's willingness to put himself in danger, his gift for oratory, and his genius as a military tactician inspired fanatical loyalty from his troops. But even they grew weary after years of constant warfare. More than once, they threatened to mutiny and return to Greece. But until they reached the malaria-ridden jungles of India, Alexander was always able to rally them for one more battle. He believed that he was a god, and that his wars of conquest demonstrated his divine power to the rest of the world. When he died in the ancient city of Babylon, his body was transported across the desert to Egypt in a golden hearse drawn by scores of horses. Yet no one worships Alexander today. No one is impressed by all the cities he named after himself, or by the city he named after his horse, or by the palace he built and filled with huge pieces of furniture so that people would think he was a giant. In fact, Alexander's influence began to evaporate soon after his death. The remains of his empire were fought over by his generals, and new conquerors soon took his place. 300 years after Alexander, Jesus Christ began to preach. Instead of an army, he had 12 men. Others tried to say he was a god, but he never said so himself. He didn't own a horse. He never founded a city. And when he died, there was no golden hearse. Yet the force of his character has endured and grown. While the most charismatic leader who ever lived is of little interest to anyone except historians. Because character is what's left after charisma is gone. I'd like to elaborate a bit on a comparison I made earlier about how creating your character is like an artist creating a sculpture. The essential point is this. I don't think character is something that just happens by itself, any more than a chisel can create a work of art without the hand of an artist guiding it. In both instances, a conscious decision has been made. A conscious process of design is at work. Character is the result of hundreds and hundreds of choices you may make that gradually turn who you are at any given moment into who you want to be. If that decision-making process is not present, you'll still be somebody. You'll still be alive, but may have a personality rather than a character. And to me, that's something very different. This has always been a country in which people have felt free to change themselves and the circumstances in which they live. In this regard, I happen to come across some interesting facts about the 19th century settlers who crossed the plains in covered wagons. For the most part, these people were neither recent arrivals on our shores, nor were they facing any special economic difficulties. Instead, they were shopkeepers, farmers, and tradesmen who simply decided to make some big changes in their lives in the hope of finding something better, despite all the dangers and uncertainties. No one really knows why this great migration began, but I suspect it had something to do with our fundamental belief in individual freedom and the idea that if there's something better at the end of the rainbow, we have a responsibility to take advantage of it. That's the basis for our discussion of character in this program. Character isn't something you were born with and can't change like your fingerprints. It's something you weren't born with and that you must take responsibility for making. You may not be able to cross the Rocky Mountains in a covered wagon, but you can still create a better life for yourself by crossing the mountains of your soul, and that may be even a greater challenge. There used to be a joke about football teams that lost every game. The coach would say, "Well, we built a lot of character this year, didn't we?" As if character is something that you settle for when you haven't achieved what you really wanted. Or as if character is something that automatically develops in you as a result of adversity. I don't buy that. I don't think adversity by itself builds character, and I certainly don't think that success erodes it. You can build character by how you respond to what happens in your life, whether it's winning every game or losing every game, or getting rich or dealing with hard times. You build character out of certain qualities that you must create and diligently nurture within yourself. Just like you would plant and water a seed, or gather wood and build a campfire. You've got to look for those things in your heart and in your gut. You've got to chisel away in order to find them, just like chiseling away rock in order to create the sculpture that has previously existed only in your imagination. But the really amazing thing about character is that if you're sincerely committed to making yourself into the person you want to be, you'll not only create those qualities, you'll strengthen them and recreate them in abundance, even as you're drawing on them every day of your life. Like the burning bush in the biblical book of Exodus, the bush that burned, but it was not consumed by the flames. Character sustains itself and nurtures itself, even as it's being put to work and tested and challenged. In this program, we're going to explore the 12 qualities that I believe are the pillars of unshakable character. We're going to talk about integrity and why doing the right thing is always in your best interest. We'll consider honesty, and we'll see why it always comes down to being honest with yourself. We'll look at perseverance, and we'll see how it can overcome virtually any obstacle. We'll explore the quality of wisdom, and we'll see why knowing the facts of a situation isn't always the same as knowing the truth. We'll discuss personal responsibility and why, like Harry Truman, you should adopt a buck stop here mentality. We'll discuss humor, and we'll see why people of character know the importance of being able to laugh at yourself. We'll define the quality of flexibility, and we'll see why it's more important today than ever before. We'll talk about patience, and we'll see why it's as important to be able to wait as it is to work. We'll look at confidence, and we'll see why being able to inspire yourself is the first step in leading others. We'll explore good health, and we'll see how a strong body and mind contribute to strong character. We'll discuss the true nature of achievement, and we'll see why it can't really be measured except in your own heart. And there's one more pillar of an unshakable character that we're going to talk about right now. As you take your metaphorical chisel in hand and set about discovering and creating the various qualities of character within yourself, you're going to need this one perhaps more than all the others. Since ancient times, philosophers have seen it as the basis of all real achievement. This is the quality of courage. There's a book that tells the stories of all the winners of the Congressional Medal of Honor. It's a book that will bring tears to your eyes. It's one of the most powerful documents ever written. One American after another who put aside all thought of safety and faced down death in the service of this country. And more often than not, it's been in order to save other Americans rather than to defeat an enemy. When you read of their exploits, you realize that these were people who simply lost their fear of death in order to do what had to be done. Yes, those Medal of Honor winners were courageous individuals, but by itself, is overcoming the fear of death necessarily an expression of courage? I don't doubt that there are many people in this country who break the law and aren't afraid to die in the process, but I wouldn't call them courageous. And there are people who do deliberately foolhardy things with their cars that jeopardize their own lives and the lives of others, but they aren't courageous people. In fact, a hungry donkey will keep eating until his stomach bursts, even if you hit him with a stick trying to make him stop. He's overcome his fear all right, but he's obviously not courageous. We might not be able to precisely define it, but we intuitively sense that there are some differences between acts of rashness and the accomplishments of those winners of the Congressional Medal of Honor. Let me sum up in a couple of sentences what those differences reveal about the true nature of courage. I can't put it any better than the Greek philosopher Aristotle did more than 2,000 years ago. A truly courageous person is not someone who never feels fear, but who fears the right thing at the right time in the right way. What exactly does that mean? What does it mean to fear the right thing in the right way at the right time? To find the answer, let's look at some specific sources of fear that many individuals are facing right now. First, a great many people today are afraid of what might happen to them financially. And it's certainly true that great changes are taking place in the economy that will have a direct impact on the lives of millions of people. I've heard it said that a corporation that employs 10,000 men and women today may only need one-fifth that many within 10 years. Over the last 50 years, whole sections of our society have learned to identify with the corporation that employed them. That corporation provided not only a salary, but health benefits, and the opportunity to create a pension fund that would make retirement possible at age 65 or even sooner. Now that relationship between the employer and the corporation is changing. Much of the work that used to be done by domestic workers can now be done more cheaply overseas, and companies are taking advantage of that, perhaps out of necessity, perhaps simply to fatten the bottom line. In any case, the fear of losing one's job has now reached a segment of the white-collar workforce that's never been faced with it in quite this way. What else are we afraid of? Many people are concerned about their health. They're afraid that they'll get sick because they're not getting enough exercise, or because they're eating the wrong things, or because of chemicals in the air or in their food or water. In fact, I think people today are even more frightened of these things than they were in the past, when epidemics of disease and poor sanitation were everywhere. And with regard to their health, people are also afraid of the expenses that might result if they were to become sick or disabled, or the expenses they might have to bear if this were to happen to a parent or a family member. So financial fears and health-related fears are two of our major concerns. But the third thing that I sense really scares people today is a bit less easy to categorize. It's kind of a general feeling that things aren't as good as they used to be, that there's been a loss of control at some basic level of our society. There's a sense that one earthquake after another, some large and obvious, some smaller and almost imperceptible, have accumulated to shift the foundations of society, and it's going to keep on shifting toward a result that's anything but good. Now, keeping in mind our idea that a courageous person is not someone who never feels fear, but who fears the right thing at the right time in the right way, let's ask ourselves if these fears really fit that definition. I think if we look a little deeper, we'll see that what really scares people about these situations is the sense that they're going to be helpless, that all their trust was placed in somebody or something, and now they've been let down and they can't do anything. They're helpless. But remember, you're never really helpless. And the sense that you are helpless, or that you might be if certain things were to happen, is something we really ought to be afraid of, and that we should refuse to accept. You're never just a victim of circumstances. No matter what happens, you're never without options that can get you back on track. It takes courage to recognize that, because it means accepting responsibility for your own future. But I would suggest that we should accept that responsibility, because no one is really going to accept it for us, no matter what we may have been led to believe. Let me emphasize that underlying most fear is the fear of helplessness, of being victimized or being blown around by the winds of fate like a leaf is blown off a tree. But is that really a legitimate way of looking at things? To me, it sounds like being afraid of the dark, in which case the best thing to do is to get yourself up, out of bed, and switch on the light. After all, the people who built this country didn't feel helpless when they faced obstacles that we can hardly even imagine today. I'm not saying we should all just gather around the campfire and tell stories about George Washington, but we should realize that every generation has faced insecurities and lived with them and triumphed over them. It's only in the past 50 years or so people have come to expect a life without real tough times and real difficulties. But adversity isn't something to fear. It's something to expect, something to prepare for, and something to overcome. The truly courageous person is not immune to fear, but it plays a different role in his or her life than it does for other people. If you're a courageous person, your fears aren't about what someone might do to you or something that might happen to you. Your fears are about not living up to your ideals, about reacting instead of acting, about not taking advantage of the opportunities that are always within reach. A truly courageous person is not afraid of what might or might not happen next week or next year. He fears not making the most of every moment today. A truly courageous person fears the impulse to dominate other people. She leads by helping others to be their best. A truly courageous person fears doing anything that he or his loved ones might be ashamed of. A truly courageous person fears making appearances more important than realities, making impressions more important than communication, making himself more important than those who are depending on him. But there's one thing a courageous person fears most. Have you ever seen a deer caught in the headlights of a car? The way the deer just stands there as though paralyzed with the car bearing down? The truly courageous person fears ever getting caught like that. And a constant part of his or her life is dedicated to making sure it never happens. In other words, the truly courageous person, as someone once said, fears nothing except fear itself. Honesty and integrity are two qualities of a strong character that are fairly easy to define. Say what you mean what you say. Do what you say you are going to do when you say you're going to do it. That's integrity. A clear correspondence between words and deeds. Don't lie, tell the truth. That's honesty. Despite the fact that these are some of the clearest, most easily recognized elements of strong character, in the real world, they're also some of the most difficult to find. It seems it's always been that way. In ancient Greece, the philosopher Demosthenes went searching for an honest man, and he never found one. I've been fortunate. I think I've known a great many honest people. But if I measured that number up against all the less than ethical people I've encountered, I guess I'd have to admit that even in my experience, honesty and integrity are rather rare. Why is that? I hope to provide some answers. But just as our discussion of courage began with a look at fear, I want to start talking about honesty by looking at the exact opposite of honest behavior. There was a time when telling a lie was very serious business. I'm speaking now of the days before lawsuits and legally enforceable contracts. In those days, lying was a very serious matter. It was also very serious if you accused someone of lying. Today, a breach of integrity in a business matter might mean calling in the lawyers. But for hundreds of years in the past, calling someone a liar was the most common way to provoke a duel, at first with swords, later with pistols. Dishonesty was treated like a personal insult that demanded immediate redress. Everyone knew the big problems that could result if you got caught, so lying to another person took a certain amount of, what's the right word, foolish bravery, maybe. But there's no such risk today, is there? Some people lie all the time without thinking about it. Most people know when they're being lied to, which they may find irritating, but they just accept it. Maybe they decide to become liars themselves. In any case, very few duels are being fought. To explain this, I think we can make a comparison between how some people today feel about lying and how they feel about money. It used to be you either had money or you didn't. When you bought something and the bill came, you had to pay it or there was an immediate problem. There were only two alternatives. You took care of your debts or you were a thief. Some people would literally take their own lives if they couldn't honor their debts. I'm sure we agree that's not exactly true any longer. Many people don't feel the same kind of personal responsibility about paying debts promptly. And today, of course, we can put off paying for our purchases as long as we can make the minimum payment on our credit card. That pain that comes with having to shell out hard cash for something, the pain of maybe having to give something up in order to have this thing, we can avoid that pain. We can put it off indefinitely as plastic debt. Of course, there's going to be a high rate of interest on that debt, and the balance due can quickly mount up. But most people don't even think about that. It's a price they're willing to pay in order to have exactly what they want right now. There are many situations where it's painful to tell the truth. It's painful in just the same way that paying a big fat bill is painful. In fact, we even use the same words to talk about paying debts and telling the truth. We may talk about somebody's word being like money in the bank. We talk about being held accountable, about having to account for yourself, about being called to account. If you've done something that you're really not proud of and you're called to account for it, well, what does that feel like? How do you handle it? What are your options when you've got to explain something that makes you uncomfortable? Well, it's a bit like that moment of decision when the credit card bill comes every month. If you want to pay off the whole balance, there may be some pain and sacrifice involved. You may have to grit your teeth. You know that your life will be simpler in the long run, but it's going to hurt a little right now to pay off the new golf clubs or the new computer. Or how about the 60-foot yacht? I don't actually know if you can put a yacht on a credit card, but I've certainly known people who would if they could. Gritting your teeth and paying in full can hurt. So quite often it seems easier to pay the minimum and delay the pain until next month. It's easier to float the truth of your finances off into a little imaginary plastic flying carpet and sail it into the mailbox. Of course, it's not really a flying carpet. It's more like a boomerang that's going to come around and hit you in the back of the head someday. But as Scarlett O'Hara once said, I guess I'll think about that tomorrow. For the time being, it's gone with the wind. Let me give you some good advice about avoiding a bankrupt character. Pay your ethical debts. Keep your integrity in the black. Face ugly realities with the truth as soon as they appear. When you feel that temptation to hedge, resist it immediately. Don't treat it casually. Treat it like a grease fire in the kitchen that you've got to put out before it burns your house down or fills the whole place up with so much smoke that you can't see where you're going anymore. Because that's exactly what will happen when your ethical capital runs out. You just won't be able to see where you're going anymore. Here's another way that being untruthful is like buying on credit. They're both addictive. At first, they both go down so easy, and they leave you wanting more. Any addictive behavior offers a simple, short-term escape from a problem. But that escape becomes more and more complicated as time goes on. Lying can get extremely complicated. You've really got to have an outstanding memory to be a good liar, because you're always having to create more lies that are consistent with the one you told in the first place. I'm sure we have at some time been caught up in a dilemma like that. Shakespeare had it right all along. What a tangled web we weave when at first we practice to deceive. Maybe you think I'm being a bit tough here. Am I really saying that in every instance you've got to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? So if somebody asked me, how are you today? I'm supposed to say, well, I got to be honest with you. I have a sore finger. Last night I had a headache. And I've got to admit that my foot hurts a little. No, that's not what I mean. In fact, I think there are many times when some flexibility with the whole truth and nothing but the truth is called for. And I'll be discussing those later. Outright lying, however, planned lying, lying with an ulterior motive, lying for personal gain, that kind of lying is definitely something to be avoided. But untruthfulness is so tempting today, and I want to spend a little more time on it. I want to make a clear distinction between what I call foolish lying or silly lying or stupid lying and lying that is downright evil and poisonous to the character. Boasting, bombast, blarney, bragging, these are all the same thing. They're always floating around in the atmosphere, and they can affect you at any time, like catching a cold. They're mostly harmless, unless you start building a whole personality around them, which has definitely happened to some people. Some other guy scored the touchdown back in high school, but you're watching the Super Bowl with your neighbor, and you say that you did it. That's pretty harmless. You really don't know Joe, the president of XYZ Corporation. You were just introduced to him one time. But the client you're trying to impress has never even shaken hands with Joe. So here's a chance to score some points. That's pretty harmless, too. You're not really the creative director of your ad agency. You're the copywriter. But a woman sitting beside you on the plane to Phoenix will never know the difference. It's harmless. Unless she walks into your office someday, and it's a small world, but you'll chance it. This is all just hot air. This is all going on that old credit card that we were talking about a moment ago. I should mention that there's such a thing as boasting in reverse, too. People who flaunt their frugality, people who poor mouth, people who are oppressively ostentatious in their lack of ostentation. This is actually becoming a bit more common. Keep an eye out for it. All of this is childish trash talk, and it's usually spontaneous. It comes from succumbing to a moment of social pressure. It's not the kind of behavior that defines strong character, but even strong characters have been known to indulge in it. Ernest Hemingway was a great writer and one of the most powerful personalities of the century. But he could be reckless, too. In any case, this kind of bragging and blarney should be distinguished from what I consider real lying. Real lying isn't like putting bills on the credit card. Real lying is like theft. In my opinion, a key element in this kind of real lying is the presence of planning and premeditation. If somebody is a supervisor in a corporation, and he steals one of his subordinates' ideas and takes credit for it in the eyes of the CEO, that requires a whole chain of events and a conscious decision to keep the deception going through the various links in the chain. That kind of lying is theft. It's not only theft of the subordinate's idea, it's stealing from the CEO, too. It's stealing the CEO's sense of reality. It's creating an illusion. If someone falsifies an earnings report in order to inflate the price of a company's stock, that's deliberately creating a mirage in the minds of the investors. In the real world, both these examples have happened, and many times lives and careers have been ruined. It's been my experience that those who engage in serious lying and unethical behavior get caught one way or the other. Usually the people who are being deceived awaken from the illusions that have been foisted upon them. But even if this never happens, the criminal, and I don't think that's too strong a word, has to buy into the illusion so deeply himself that his own sense of reality is eroded. By trying to loosen other people's grasp of the truth, you end up losing your own. All of it. Small-time lying and big-time deceit. It all comes from fear. Somebody is afraid the truth about themselves isn't good enough, so they depart from the truth. Somebody secretly fears that they can't really come up with ideas of their own, so they steal somebody else's ideas. Or they fear their company isn't really going to succeed, so they come up with a way to inflate the share prices. It's really cowardice. Remember what we said about courage? Courage is fearing the right thing at the right time and in the right way. Fear the temptation to misrepresent who you are or what you've done or intend to do. Trust who you really are. Trust your ability to earn the respect of others. pay whatever price the truth costs. Pay that bill immediately. Because in the long run, it's a real bargain. When you're in a leadership position, whether it's in a business or as the head of a family, honesty and integrity are not as important as money or shelter or a telephone. Honesty and integrity are infinitely more important than any of those things. They're about as important as having air and food and water. For a leader, honesty and integrity are absolutely essential to survival. A lot of business people don't realize how closely they're being watched by their subordinates. Remember when you were a kid in grammar school? How you used to sit there staring at your teacher all day? By the end of the school year, I'll bet you could have done a perfect imitation of all your teacher's mannerisms. I'll bet you were aware of the slightest nuances in your teacher's voice. All the little clues that distinguished levels of meaning, that told you the difference between bluff and, now I mean business. You were able to do that after 8 or 9 months of observation. Suppose you had 5 or 10 years. Do you think there would have been anything about your teacher you didn't know? As a manager, there probably isn't anything your people don't know about you right this minute. If you haven't been totally above board and honest with them, it's certain you haven't gotten away with it. But if you've been led to believe that you've gotten away with it, it's most likely because people are afraid of you. That's a problem in its own right. But there's another side of the coin, too. In any organization, people want to believe in their leaders. If you give them reason to trust you, they're not going to go looking for reasons to think otherwise. And they'll be just as perceptive about your positive qualities as they are about the negative ones. I heard a story of a situation that happened some time ago at a company in the Midwest. The wife of a new employee experienced complications in the delivery of a baby. There was a medical bill of more than $10,000, and the health insurance didn't want to cover it. The employee hadn't been on the payroll long enough. The pregnancy was a pre-existing condition, one thing or another. In any case, the employee was desperate. He approached the company CEO and asked him to talk to the insurance people. The CEO agreed, and the next thing the employee knew, the bill was gone. The charges were rescinded. But when he mentioned to some colleagues the way the CEO had so readily used his influence with the insurance company, they just shook their heads and smiled. The CEO had paid the bill out of his own pocket, and everybody knew it, no matter how quietly it had been done. An act of dishonesty can't be hidden, and it will instantly undermine the authority of a leader. But an act of integrity is just as obvious to all concerned. When you're in a leadership position, you have the choice of how you will be seen. But you will be seen one way or the other. Make no mistake about that. Leadership of a family demands even higher standards of honesty and integrity. And the stakes are higher, too. You can replace disgruntled employees and start over. You can even get a new job for yourself if it comes to that. But your family can't be shuffled like a deck of cards. If you haven't noticed, kids are great moral philosophers, especially as they get into adolescence. They're determined to discover and expose any kind of hypocrisy, phoniness, or lack of integrity on the part of authority figures. And if we're parents, that means us. It's frightening how unforgiving kids can be about this, but it really isn't a conscious decision on their part. It's just a necessary phase of growing up. They're testing everything, especially parents. In Arthur Miller's great play, Death of a Salesman, it's hard to believe that a son would so completely lose faith in his father based on a single incident of dishonesty. Once a parent has lost moral authority, it is very, very difficult to regain it. Studies have shown that children are extremely understanding about many things. If you accidentally step on a favorite toy, that will quickly be forgiven, if not forgotten. If you lose your job and the family has to move, they'll adjust. If parents just can't get along and decide to divorce, most kids can handle it, but they can't handle dishonesty. It can take many, many years before that will be forgiven. Many people keep pictures of their kids on their desks. Is it supposed to be a reminder of what they looked like? Is it showing them off for whoever comes into the office? Well, there is an even more important reason those pictures are there, or why they should be there. They're there to remind us of what's at stake when we make the decisions that determine character. And we all make many of those decisions every day. As a person of integrity yourself, you'll find it easy to teach integrity to your kids, and they in turn will find it easy to accept you as a teacher. This is a great opportunity and also a supreme responsibility, because kids simply must be taught to tell the truth, to mean what they say, and to say what they mean. There was something interesting about the Indians of the Southwest and the skills they felt were important for their children to know. Hiding was one of them. In a desert environment where you would think there was nowhere at all to hide except possibly by squeezing yourself behind a cactus plant, the Indian children could literally disappear. And running was another very important ability. Beginning as young as 6 or 7 years of age, Indian children were taught to run long distances while holding a mouthful of water in order to develop breath control. And of course, both running and hiding were skills that could save the life of an Indian child, as well as preserve the security of the group. Kids today must be taught skills that will save their lives. And integrity is one of those vitally important skills. Maybe it's hard to convince yourself of that. I heard a story of a man who flew propeller-driven anti-submarine planes for the Navy, piloted them on long flights over the water. He told of an incident when a storm was coming up, and they were faced with a difficult navigational problem in order to avoid it. The problem became even more difficult when the navigator revealed that he couldn't handle it. He cheated his way through some parts of the training, but that training material didn't seem like it would ever be very useful. I can't promise that it will ever save their lives, but nothing you will ever do is more important than teaching integrity to your children. There's an old saying, those who do can, and those who can't teach. But you really can't teach honesty unless you are honest yourself. You really can't teach integrity unless you also live with integrity. It's actually quite simple. Earlier I suggested that there might be some times when a certain amount of flexibility with the truth is appropriate. And I'd like to return to that now. It might be tempting, for the sake of consistency, to assert that you should always tell the whole truth exactly as you see it in every situation. But I've lived long enough in the real world to know things just aren't that simple. Shakespeare wrote of one of his characters, "Every man has his fault, and honesty is his. He is more honest than wise." Just as there is a difference between blowing hot air and premeditated dishonesty, there's also a difference between lying and recognizing the importance of diplomacy. How can you tell the difference? Your gut feelings will tell you. By the time we reach adulthood, I think most of us have extremely accurate ethical barometers built into our heads and hearts. We may choose to ignore what that ethical barometer tells us, but it's there nonetheless. When you're in a leadership role, I believe there's at least one situation in which you're almost always justified in stretching the truth to some degree. And here it is. You should overstate your degree of enthusiasm for your employees' work. You may use many, many carrots and very few sticks. Your recipe for dealing with subordinates should include at least 3 parts praise for every 1 part of criticism. Will this stretching of the truth cost you respect? I don't think so. Will a little sugarcoating of your true feelings foster greater productivity, better work, and improved morale? Absolutely. And that conclusion is supported by a great deal of behavioral science research. Praise is one of the world's most effective teaching and leadership tools. Criticism and blame, even if deserved, are counterproductive unless all other approaches have failed. Vince Lombardi, the late coach of the Green Bay Packers, certainly deserved his reputation as a tough manager and a man of strong character. But even he knew the importance of building up people's ego. You could have seen how this worked if you had the opportunity to attend a practice session of the Packers during the years when they were one of the most powerful football teams ever assembled. Lombardi had a quarterback from his scout team throwing passes against the first-string defense. And this young quarterback was obviously eager to impress the coach. But after the player had completed 3 or 4 passes in a row, Lombardi seemed anything but impressed. In fact, he seemed quite displeased. And he took the scrub quarterback aside. "What are you trying to do, wreck my team?" Lombardi snarled. "Start throwing interceptions." And you'd better believe he started throwing them. We can call it diplomacy or psychology or just plain flattery, but it often brings out the best in people, and it's the grease that keeps the machine of human interactions functioning smoothly. So honesty is the best policy, but sometimes a little less than total honesty is even better. We've been talking mostly about the importance of honesty and integrity in dealing with other people. But I want to conclude now by focusing on what those qualities mean to your relationship with yourself. I think a term from clinical psychology is useful here. The term is cognitive dissonance. And I'll use a quick example to illustrate what it means. Let's consider a man who is an expert on personal financial planning. He makes a good living advising people about life insurance, trust funds, and the various kinds of mortgages. But a great deal of his business is devoted to helping individuals who have gotten themselves deeply into debt, who need to tear up their credit cards and start saving instead of spending. Sometimes there is no alternative but declaring bankruptcy and starting over. We are so surprised when one day this expert on personal financial planning says that he is going out of business. "I just can't take the pressure anymore. It's too much stress." Well, we can understand that. It must be stressful facing the problems of one person after another who's gotten into trouble financially, to work through it with them day in and day out. But here is the big surprise. "I'm the one who's in trouble financially," he suddenly admits. "I'm behind on everything, even my car payment. And after lecturing about the perils of debt all day, I can't stand to look in the mirror anymore." Wow. This man is experiencing cognitive dissonance in an extreme form. He is trying to live with 2 conflicting images of himself in his head. And the strain is simply using up all his energy. He's fundamentally a good person. He really believes in doing the right thing. But that's the trouble. He knows he's living a lie, and the stress of that finally gets to him. You might be surprised by the percentage of high-level managers and professional people who secretly know that they're presenting a false image to the world. The need to keep up appearances, the competition with peers, the pressure to make every year better than the last one, all this can make it very tempting to put on a mask. I'm not talking about just boasting here. I'm talking about creating a real split between what you're telling the world and what you know is the real truth about yourself. All the world's a stage, and to some extent we're all playing roles, but living with honesty and integrity can make it all a great deal easier. This is where ethics and psychology really overlap. Not only is it right to minimize cognitive dissonance, in the long run, it's a lot easier on your psyche. We all know people who have gotten ahead as a result of dishonest or unethical behavior. When you're a kid, you think that never happens. But when you get older, you realize that it does. Then you think you've really wised up. But that's not the end of it. When you get older, you see the long-term consequences of dishonest gain, and you realize that it doesn't pay in the end. I've seen people who have made millions with questionable business tactics, and I've also seen a higher percentage of health problems among those people than any insurance actuary could possibly account for. I've seen people who decided to sell out their friends or their business partners in order to cash a big check, and those people wind up looking 20 years older than their age. Stick around, keep your eyes open, and I think you'll see it's true. Hope of dishonest gain is the beginning of loss. That's another old saying. I don't think it refers to the loss of money. I think it means loss of self-respect. You can have all the material things in the world, but if you've lost respect for yourself, what have you really got? The only way to ever attain success and enjoy it is to achieve it honestly and with pride in what you've done. Hey, that's not just a sermon. That's very practical advice. You can not only take it to heart, you can take it to the bank.